From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Honor, integrity, commitment, and service. These are the attributes of Tatiana Jefferson. And yet, in the early mornings of October 11, 2019, she was simply going on along with her life, living a law-abiding, a citizen's peaceful life, and she was killed by a reckless act of a Fort Worth police officer.
In Fort Worth, Texas, a white police officer has been arrested and charged with murder after he shot and killed an African-American woman inside her own home. The officer was responding to a non-emergency call after a neighbor saw a Tatiana Jefferson's front door was open. We'll speak to civil rights attorney Lee Merritt, who's representing the Jefferson family. Then to homewreckers, how a gang of Wall Street kingpins, hedge fund magnates, crooked banks, and vulture capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream.
8 million Americans lost their homes in the Great Recession, and all of those homes went somewhere, and we haven't been tracking it. And what I learned writing my book is that a small group of vulture capitalists surrounding Donald Trump, they're the ones who made off with a killing while the rest of us suffered.
We'll speak to award-winning reporter Aaron Glantz on his new book, Homewreckers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Syrian troops have advanced across northern Syria after the Syrian regime struck a deal to protect the Kurds from Turkey's deadly air and ground assault. The deal comes after the United States pulled its troops out of northern Syria, paving the way for the Turkish offensive. On Monday, the U.S. announced it's imposing sanctions against Turkey over the military offensive and called on the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to implement an immediate ceasefire. Vice President Mike Pence and National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien will soon travel to Turkey. This is Pence speaking Monday.
President Erdogan reached out and requested the call. President Trump communicated to him very clearly that the United States of America wants Turkey to stop the invasion, to implement an immediate ceasefire, and to begin to negotiate with Kurdish forces in Syria to bring an end to the violence.
The New York Times is reporting U.S. State and Energy Department officials have been considering plans to evacuate the approximately 50 tactical nuclear weapons the United States stores at the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The Committee to Protect Journalists says a Turkish airstrike on a civilian convoy killed a journalist and wounded at least four others in northern Syria Sunday. The slain reporter, Saad Ahmed, was a Syrian Kurdish journalist for the local agency Hawar News. The London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least five other civilians were also killed in the Turkish airstrike. The invasion has forced over 100,000 civilians to flee the area and has provoked international outrage. All 28 European Union member states have now agreed to stop selling arms to Turkey, an unprecedented step toward a NATO member. Turkey launched the invasion after President Trump had a conversation with the Turkish President Erdogan. In news from Washington, President Trump's former top Russia adviser, Fiona Hill, testified in front of the House Intelligence, Foreign Affairs and Oversight Committees Monday as part of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. She told lawmakers that former National Security Advisor John Bolton referred to Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, as a hand grenade who's going to blow everyone up, unquote. She also testified. He said, quote, "I am not part of what other drug deals Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up," referring to the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, and White House acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. Democrats have accused Giuliani of running a shadow foreign policy by pushing for the ouster of U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and pressuring Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. Hunter spoke to ABC Monday, saying his foreign business deal showed poor judgment. but were not illegal. Sondland is slated to testify later this week. So is Bill Taylor, now the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine. In released text messages between the two men, Taylor texted Sondland, "Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?" Sondland texted back, "Call me." 12 Democratic candidates will take the stage in Westerville, Ohio, tonight for a 2020 presidential primary debate. Heading into tonight, a number of new polls show Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren leading the pack after surging ahead of former Vice President Joe Biden. News reports say former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg is reportedly considering jumping into the Democratic primary race if Joe Biden withdraws. The CNN and New York Times-hosted debate will begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. In Fort Worth, Texas, white police officer Aaron Dean has been arrested and charged with murder after he shot and killed a 28-year-old African-American woman named Tatiana Jefferson inside her own home. Officer Dean was responding to a non-emergency call from a neighbor for a wellness check after the neighbor saw Jefferson's front door open. Soon after the officers arrived, Dean shouted through Jefferson's bedroom window to put her hands up and then immediately opened fire, killing her. He never identified himself as a police officer. Minutes before the shooting, Jefferson had been playing video games with her 8-year-old nephew. This is the family's attorney, Lee Merritt.
This was a wellness call. It's beyond me to begin to understand what kind of police force responds to a wellness call with the equivalent of SWAT. This department and their officers violated not only the rights of Tay Jefferson and her family, but they just made common sense mistakes.
We'll speak to attorney Lee Merritt after headlines. A federal judge has ruled President Trump broke the law when he declared a national emergency in order to secure billions of dollars of Pentagon funds to build his border wall, parts of which are already under construction. Federal District Court Judge David Briones said Friday Trump violated a provision of budget law approved by Congress. Meanwhile, in Arizona, a video has gone viral showing bulldozers destroying protected cacti to make way for the wall, which is slated to cut through the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument and International Biosphere Reserve. The Trump administration's waived 41 environmental rules in order to allow for border wall construction. Trump has said his border wall will be impenetrable and claimed 20 world-class mountain climbers said it would be hard to climb. But a slew of amateur climbers have easily scaled a prototype of the wall built by the owner of a climbing park in Kentucky, including an 8-year-old girl named Lucy Hancock, who scaled the wall in about a minute. Protests are continuing in Barcelona, Spain, following the Spanish Supreme Court's decision to sentence 9 Catalan separatist leaders to prison over their role in Catalonia's 2017 bid for independence. On Monday, thousands of protesters blocked access to Barcelona's airport. More than 100 flights were canceled. In Mexico, 14 police officers were killed in an ambush in the state of Michoacán. The attack is being blamed on the new generation Jalisco cartel, which is battling for control over the methamphetamine, avocado and lime industries in the southwestern Mexico state. In Hong Kong, tens of thousands of activists rallied Monday, calling on U.S. lawmakers to pass the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. The legislation could be discussed by the House as early as this week. It would allow for sanctions to be levied against those deemed to be suppressing basic freedoms in Hong Kong. Protests were also held across Hong Kong over the weekend, with at least 200 people arrested. The City of London has banned all Extinction Rebellion protests and cleared the protest encampment at Trafalgar Square after over 1,400 people were arrested in 8 days of mass demonstrations demanding urgent action to address the climate crisis. On Monday morning, hundreds of people blocked traffic outside the Bank of England, while other activists glued themselves to the offices of Barclays Bank, military contractor BAE System, and asset manager manager BlackRock.
This company are one of the major reasons this earth is in such a mess. And I know there'll be people inside in BlackRock who are working hard to provide for their kids. And surely they'll get the message that they're the ones who are making their future less safe and their planet not fit for habitation.
Despite the ban, Extinction Rebellion protests are continuing in London today, where the group's co-founder, Gail Bradbrook, tried to smash one of the windows of the Department of Transport with a hammer while other activists glued themselves to the building. To see our full interview with Dr. Bradbrook, go to democracynow.org. In Ecuador, President Lenin Moreno signed a new decree on Monday to revert fuel prices back to the subsidized levels after the government and indigenous groups struck a deal to end 2 weeks of massive indigenous-led protests. Under the agreement reached Sunday night, Ecuador did not withdraw from the $4.2 billion International Monetary Fund loan, as we and other media outlets reported. A special commission has now been set up in which indigenous leaders and other social organizations will negotiate plans to reduce Ecuador's deficit. Tens of thousands of General Motors workers have entered their fifth week of strike as negotiations between the United Auto Workers and the car manufacturing giant continue. Workers are seeking higher pay, protection of their health care benefits, greater job security, and a commitment from GM to build more cars and parts in the United States. It's the longest national strike at GM by the United Auto Workers in nearly half a century. And Native American communities marked Indigenous Peoples Day Monday, holding sunrise ceremonies from coast to coast, from New York City's Randall's Island to California's Alcatraz Island. Eight states and over 130 cities and counties have stopped recognizing the federal holiday of Columbus Day and now recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. In New York, hundreds of protesters rallied outside the American Museum of Natural History's statue of U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt, who's depicted riding on a horse above an indigenous person and enslaved person on both sides of him. Protesters have long called for the statue's removal. This is Daisy Bugarin.
These museums and these institutional spaces try to tell this narrative that never was, right? By glorifying the supremacists like Teddy, by glorifying the white man, and also by telling a narrative that is not coming from our voice and having these artifacts of these people that were supposedly, it's almost as if we've been extinct and we're not. So when we come, we're reclaiming what is our identity, and we're also showing the world that we still exist, that we are still resisting. And beyond that, that our struggles are all one against capitalism, against imperialism.
That's Daisy Bugarin of Semilla Collective. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our viewers and listeners across the country and around the world. We begin in Fort Worth, Texas, where a white police officer has been arrested and charged with murder after he shot and killed a 28-year-old African-American woman who was inside her own home. Officer Aaron Dean was responding to a non-emergency call for a wellness check after a neighbor contacted the Fort Worth police to report that Tatiana Jefferson's front door was open at around 2:30 in the morning on Saturday. Soon after the officers arrived, Dean shouted through Jefferson's bedroom window to put her hands up. He then immediately opened fire, killing her. He never identified himself as a police officer. Minutes before the shooting, Jefferson had been playing video games with her 8-year-old nephew, who witnessed the shooting but was not physically injured. Fort Worth Police Sergeant Chris Daniels announced the arrest of Officer Aaron Dean on Monday.
The Fort Worth Police Department would again like to express our deepest condolences to Ms. Jefferson's family. We understand that this is a tough and tragic event, not only for her family, but for the community. We value the trust that we've had with our community. We will continue to build that trust, and we will continue to be as transparent as possible in all police matters. Concerning the status of the criminal investigation, at approximately 6 p.m., Aaron Dean was arrested for the murder of Ms. Jefferson.
Officer Aaron Dean's arrest came just hours after he resigned from the police department amidst growing outrage. Tatiana Jefferson's family also held a news conference Monday before Dean's arrest. This is the family's lawyer, Lee Merritt, addressing reporters.
I want to go ahead and dispel the myth that this is somehow a one-off, that this was just, a bad luck incident from an otherwise sound department. The Fort Worth Police Department is on pace to be one of the deadliest police departments in the United States. They're in need of serious systematic reform. We are asking that the federal government comes in, the Department of Justice comes in and takes a heavy, a conscious look at the policies and procedures that allowed something like this tragedy to happen. They created a deadly situation, and they responded in a way that is not unique to the city of Fort Worth. In the last 6 months, they've had 10 officer-involved shootings, seven officer-involved deaths. That's more than most nations for one, a single city in Texas. It represents a serious problem that must be addressed.
Tatiana Jefferson is the seventh person since June who's been killed by one of the police department's officers. Her killing comes after white off-duty police officer Amber Geiger was convicted of murder for killing her black neighbor, Botham Jean, in his own apartment in nearby Dallas. She said she thought it was her apartment. Well, for more, we're joined by civil rights attorney Lee Merritt, who's representing the Jefferson family. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Lee Merritt. Why don't you lay out exactly what you understand took place?
Tay Jefferson's neighbor, and I'm sorry, the family calls her Tay. That's Tatiana Jefferson. His neighbor called law enforcement. He called a non-emergency number because he noticed that the doors were open. The doors were open because the family was inside. Tay and her nephew, Zion, were inside. It was a cool night, and they were enjoying the first fall breeze in the Texas area. But he was concerned that the owner of the house, Ms. Yolanda, who had a heart condition, may have been suffering an emergency. And so he called the non-emergency number to say, to check on her wellness. He gave them the information that you have, that he was concerned because the door was not usually left open. The city of Fort Worth responded by sending out a tactical unit, their equivalent of SWAT. They parked their cars around the corner. They crept up to the property. They passed two open doors, two open and lit doors, and went around the back of the property with unmarked officers without announcing themselves, with wearing black uniforms because of their tactical position. As they were creeping around the back of the house, Tay from the inside and her nephew Zion heard noises. Tay went to the window to investigate. And the next thing that she knew, there was an officer, someone she wouldn't have known to be a police officer, shouting commands. And within 0.6 seconds, I had an expert break down the video, 0.6 seconds after the command, he shot her.
Well, Mr. Merritt, in terms of what you said in the press conference and what people are aware of, there have been 10 shootings in basically less than 6 months, seven of them fatal by the Fort Worth Police Department. This is a police department that has less than 1,700 officers. This is an astonishing number. What is your sense of what's going on in Fort Worth?
Well, that's really the important question, and it's significant at this point because I believe that they're going to try to scapegoat this officer who's been with the force for less than a year. He's a problem. He should be prosecuted. What he did was criminal. But who gave him the order to show up to this private home with a tactical unit? And what's going on in the policing culture in Fort Worth that is allowing for deadly force to be used so often? Is there de-escalation training? Are they recruiting the appropriate individuals to serve as police officers within this community? Are they responding differently to black communities than they are to predominantly white areas within the city? All of these things need to be brought into question as we move on, not only from this tragedy, but figure out how to stop these things from reoccurring.
I wanted to get your response to former Fort Worth Police Chief Joel Fitzgerald, who released a statement Sunday criticizing the city's handling of the shooting. He said, yesterday, a different officer shoots an innocent woman in response to a welfare check call. In response, we have been presented with blurred pictures of an alleged weapon, a five-minute press conference with no details from a lieutenant who, to his chagrin, presented no solutions. During this time of crisis, where is the interim police chief? Where is POA President Manny Ramirez? Where is Mayor Price? Why weren't they at Sunday's news conference? Why was no substantive information provided? On May 19, 2019, when my department successfully rescued an abducted girl from a kidnapper, they raced to the microphone to seek credit and fame. Yet today, when our community needs them more than ever, they're noticeably and inexcusably absent. There's a vacuum of leadership, and these individuals must be held accountable. Now, that's a statement from the former Fort Worth Police Chief Joel Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald, who is African-American, was fired in May after a confrontation with the president of a Texas statewide police union during a conference and is fighting to get his job back. His supporters say police shootings of African-Americans have skyrocketed since his firing. And his attorney, Stephen Kennedy, said in a statement, had Dr. Fitzgerald been reinstated months ago, a Tatiana probably would be alive today, and the number of police shootings would not be in double digits. Lee Merritt, are you also calling for his reinstatement, and do you share his assessment?
I share his assessment, but the numbers weren't significantly better during Chief Fitzgerald's tenure. I look forward to leadership within the Fort Worth Police Department that reflects the words that he's saying, but the policies that he pursued while the chief of police did not reduce instances of brutality significantly. I was first introduced to Mr. Fitzgerald in the case of Jacqueline Craig. Now, Fitzgerald did do the right thing in that incident, where a mother called the police after her neighbor choked her 8-year-old son. And instead of helping that mother with that incident, a white police officer arrived and brutalized that mom and her teenage daughters. Chief Fitzgerald suspended that officer for 10 days, and that was the end of his punishment. And then Chief Fitzgerald went about punishing black police officers who he believed made statements derogatory towards the apartment, concerning how this case was handled by the city. So he's now speaking some of the same language as those department chiefs that he punished during that incident. Well, I say all that to say, the rhetoric is popular right now, but we need people who are actually going to pursue plans, policy procedures, training, and take real steps and pursue significant initiatives to actually change the policing culture. Chief Fitzgerald sounds like he's reformed and he's ready to make some changes, but we need to see that manifest itself in actual action.
Well, Lee Merritt, I wanted to ask you about this whole issue of the police unions. In many cities, the police unions are the ones that have enormous influence over the politicians and how they deal with police conduct. What's the situation there in Fort Worth with the influence of the police union? Because obviously it is kind of strange that neither the mayor nor the chief of police attended a press conference to talk about this particular issue.
Yes, the police union in Fort Worth, just like the police union in the city of Dallas, where Bolton Jean was killed just last year, exercise an enormous amount of influence. And that influence normally or typically comes down on behalf of police misconduct. And so they work pretty hard to ensure that there won't be accountability for officers who are engaged or found responsible for malfeasance. The police unions have blood on their hands, to speak frankly, and it's that culture and that share in the blame for the staggering numbers that you see coming out of Fort Worth.
I want wanted to go to James Smith, Tay Jefferson's neighbor, who called the police, actually called a non-emergency line. He's speaking to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
2 o'clock a.m., I got a call from my niece, and she alerted me that my neighbor's door was open. Both her doors, both her front doors open, which was unusual for the neighbor. So I came over to see if there was anything wrong. I noticed that all the lights were in the house were on. I didn't see any movement. So instead of going in, I went back home and I called the Fort Worth Police Department to come out and do a welfare check to make sure my neighbor was okay. 15 minutes later, I heard a loud noise and I saw 5 or 10 police officers surrounding the house. And I don't know what happened on the inside of the house. All I know is my neighbor is dead. They came out and got a statement from me because I was the one that called them. They took my statement. They told me that the detective would come talk to me and tell me what was going on. I've yet to see the detective.
Again, that was James Smith calling for a welfare check, what's known as a wellness check, to check that everything is okay. On Monday, Tatiana's sister, Amber Carr, spoke at a news conference. Her young son was with her sister, Tay, playing video games when the former Fort Worth police officer, Aaron Dean, opened fire, killing her with one shot.
My son, who was there to witness the event, you would think that, you know, he would show some type of sadness or emotions. But the first time I actually got to see him and pick him up from a facility for children, the first thing he told me was he was sad. And I asked him, why was he sad? And he told me because the police had killed his, had shot his aunt. And at that time, I knew nothing about that. So he was the one who actually told me what happened. But at this time, he's my motivation. He's my biggest encourager. In the middle of the night when I'm crying, he wakes up and tells me to breathe in my nose and out my mouth. He holds me. He hugs me. And these are the things I should be doing for him.
Again, that was Amber Carr. It was her little boy, 8-year-old Zion, who was with his aunt, Tay. They were playing video games in the bedroom when the police officer, Aaron Dean, simply opened fire within a second of looking in that window. Now, apparently, the police department was about to fire him, but he resigned first, and then he was charged with murder. Lee Merritt, that's very unusual. Can you talk about your response to this charge?
It again shows that the Fort Worth Police Department is aware of how not only bad this incident is, but how really on the brink the community is. If they hadn't made an arrest with an appropriate charge, there was going to be civil unrest in the city, and appropriately so. Not only is this murder devastating to this community, it came at a time where people are beginning to realize throughout the Dallas-Fort Worth area that policing culture is out of control. That clip of 10 officer-involved shootings in this one really small city in the state of Texas is unacceptable. And as you all know, it's just indicative of a policing culture throughout the United States that represents one of the deadliest police cultures in the modern world. There's not too many nations that can compare with the United States in terms of what we allow for the use of force. It's something that the community is awakened to, and they're not going to continue to tolerate.
And Lee Merritt, what about the issue that there were, at least in this instance, there was video cam footage of the officer's camera? Had there not been, then it would have been basically whatever the officers on the scene claimed happened would have had a lot more credence. To what degree do you think this was important or critical in this particular case? And the fact that it was released so quickly. Often police departments hold back on releasing such video.
The body cam footage and body cam footage throughout the United States has played a pivotal role in holding police officers accountable. some of the times where we don't see the community investment is when those videos are withheld from the public until public outcry dies down. So it was critical that that video was released so quickly that we could learn what happened, because as you mentioned, otherwise it would be the word of an 8-year-old versus that of the law enforcement community of the city of Fort Worth. Now, I spoke with Zion the day after this happened, and he recalls in vivid detail everything that happened that night. Unfortunately, he is going to probably play a pivotal role in this case, because this officer is not going to simply accept that he is responsible for his actions. But this will likely result in a trial, and Zion is going to have to endure that. And his family, of course, is concerned about his psychological well-being, making sure that he receives the treatment that he needs during this
time. I want to go to Fort Worth Pastor Kiev Tatum speaking Monday.
The only one, I guess we could say, hey, you know, a mistake is a mistake. But we're going back to 2009 when Michael Jacobs was killed with 55 tasers on a welfare check. We're talking about Ra-Ra Thomas, who was taking his children for their birthday. Police pulls them over, shoot 12 times in the car. We're talking about Kevin Goldstein, who was going to the store, blocked in the front and the back, shot over 12 times. We're talking about so many others. Since May the 20th, 2019, we've had 10, not 9, 10 police-involved shootings, with over 7 of them being African-American, and the last 3 were all under 30.
That's Pastor Kiev Tatum. Now, Lee Merritt, I also want to ask you about the neighboring city, about Dallas, about the recent killing of Joshua Brown, who is a key witness in the murder trial of former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger. Brown lived across the hall from Botham Jean, the black 26-year-old accountant who was shot and killed in 2018 inside his own apartment by his neighbor, Amber Geiger, who is a white officer off duty at the time. During the trial, Brown gave emotional testimony about hearing gunshots the night of Botham Jean's murder. 2 days after Geiger was sentenced to in the case to 10 years, Joshua Brown was shot to death outside his apartment. Dallas police have arrested 2 suspects and have identified a 3rd in Brown's murder, which they characterize as a drug deal gone bad. The Dallas NAACP is calling for an independent investigation. Lee Merritt, you represented the Botham Jean family in the trial. Now you also represent the family of Joshua Brown. Can you give us the latest?
Well, the Dallas Police Department is chugging forward with an investigation that will be held suspect by the Dallas community and really by the national community until they hand it over to a disinterested third-party investigator. They have found witnesses and evidence, and they've presented that to the public. And for a significant sector of the community, they've simply rejected their findings because Dallas, whether they like it or not, whether there's even evidence of it or not, is implicated in this murder because it came at the time, 2 days after a conviction for a Dallas police officer during a trial that revealed corruption within the city of Dallas. You ask yourself, is the Dallas Police Department capable of murder? Well, yeah, there was a police officer who was just convicted of murder. Are they capable of this level of corruption? Well, yeah, during the trial, you learned that the Dallas Police Officer Association President Mike Mata actively covered up for the murderer, Amber Geiger. You learned that her partner, who remains on the force, was actively deleting text messages and other evidence as it relates to this case. So Dallas Police Department is simply not qualified to perform this investigation. I have a vested interest in ensuring that the conclusions of their investigation into the murder of Joshua Brown is reliable to the community, because I don't want the chilling effect of individuals afraid of testifying against police officers in fear of retribution. And so this investigation must be done thoroughly, but it must be done by someone who is not implicated in the case.
Mr. Merritt, you wrote on social media that the state knew Joshua Brown didn't want to testify due to concerns for his safety. He even flew to California when the trial began, and they threatened him with jail if he didn't return. He went straight from the airport to the court. Dallas County had a duty to protect him, and they failed.
That's right. And so that's actually what the family has hired me to investigate, is how much did the city know? And I've learned that that not only Joshua Brown reported to the DA that he was not interested in testifying in this trial, but that his mother, who was a bit of a helicopter mom, said she told the DA herself when they were looking for him to present during the grand jury testimony that he was afraid to testify in this trial. When you have that kind of concern from a citizen that you're asking to speak, you have an obligation to provide them every protection necessary. It's important to note that Joshua Brown's testimony, while emotionally jarring and powerful, was duplicative. It was not necessary in this trial in order to obtain a conviction. Everything he testified to was brought in through other witnesses. He's been widely reported as a key witness because of the compelling nature of his testimony, but he certainly wasn't a critical witness in the sense that without him, conviction would likely still have occurred.
So finally, we just have a minute, but what does this mean for the community? You go from the Amber Geiger trial, conviction and 10-year sentence for the white police officer who killed Botham Jean, to the murder of Joshua, and now Joshua Brown, and now you have Tatiana Jefferson just gunned down in cold blood in her bedroom by a police officer, now charged with murder.
For the community of the DFW, as what is called locally, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I truly believe that this is a Selma moment. The community is simply fed up with police brutality, and it's intolerable. It's always been intolerable. But because of these series of events happening back-to-back-to-back on a national and even international scale, there are so many people who have focused their attention on the DFW area. We're not going to allow law enforcement to scapegoat officers or make excuses or justifications. We are all realizing collectively that there is a deeper problem that is further rooted in racism, that is further rooted in a culture that allows for far too much brutality without accountability. And there are going to have to be significant long-term changes. And it's not going to happen through osmosis, but people are going to have to get out into the streets and fight for it. They're going to have to show up to the polls and fight for it. They're going to have to sit around in think tanks within the community and come up with new plans and new initiatives until this issue is resolved. This is not going to stop with the conviction of this officer, because we realized with the conviction of Amber Geiger that was simply not going to be enough to solve the problem, because days later, bodies began to pile up again. This is going to require a long-term campaign, and I believe the Dallas-Fort Worth area will be ground zero for that campaign nationally.
Lee Merritt, thanks so much for being with us. Civil rights attorney representing the family of Tay Jefferson, of Tatiana Jefferson. When we come back, Aaron Glantz on his new book, Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Stay with us.
Ooh, Lord, ain't my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Went down the hill the other day. Soul got happy and stayed all day. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so high. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so high. Went in the room, didn't stay long. looked on the bed and brother was dead.
Trouble So Hard by Vera Hall. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!
Well, 12 Democratic presidential hopefuls will spar this evening at Audubon University in Westerville, Ohio, during the fourth official Democratic primary debate. As voters weigh their options, one of the pressing issues on many Americans' minds is housing. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont is the latest 2020 Democratic presidential candidate to release a comprehensive Housing for All plan. He has advocated for rent control, called for big investments in affordable and subsidized housing, and has also pushed for reforms in zoning laws to allow construction in more expensive neighborhoods. Meanwhile, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced the American Housing and Economic Mobility Act last year, which is the basis of her proposed affordable housing plan, calling for expanding fair housing legislation, building or rehabilitating millions of low and middle-income housing units, and reforming zoning laws. Several other candidates, including Senators Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, have released detailed plans to tackle the housing challenges of ordinary Americans, many who are still struggling after the devastating 2008 housing market collapse.
When we spend the rest of the hour on a new book that looks at the devastating legacy of the foreclosure crisis and how much of the so-called recovery is a result of large private equity firms buying up hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes, the book is by investigative reporter Aaron Glantz. It's called Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. In it, Aaron Glantz reveals how the 2008 housing crash decimated millions of Americans' family wealth, but enriched President Donald Trump's inner circle, including Trump cabinet members Steve Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross, Trump's longtime friend and confidant Tom Barrack, and billionaire Republican donor Steve Schwarzman. Aaron Glantz joins us now, senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, finalist for a Pulitzer Prize this year for his reporting on modern-day redlining. His new book, Homewreckers, comes out today. It's great to have you with us, Aaron. What an amazing book. Just lay out what you found.
Well, first of all, I wanted to know, 8 million Americans lost their homes in the Great Recession. But they didn't just disappear, right? So we live now in a society where the wealth gap between the richest one-tenth of 1% and the other 90% is bigger than it's been in 100 years. And so much of Americans' wealth is in their homes, because we have very few other ways to save. So I wanted to know what happened to these houses, who profited off this mess. And that trail led me to a number of people who are in Donald Trump's inner circle.
So talk about them and talk about how they benefited.
Well, we start with the crash itself and the failure of the banks. When all of these bad loans came due and there was massive foreclosures, we, the taxpayers, the government, subsidized those foreclosures. And there were a lot of people who lost money during that time, but there were also people who bet on these failed banks and received government support to foreclose. And that included, as you mentioned, Steve Mnuchin, who's now our Treasury Secretary. He and his group of other investors, including George Soros, John Paulson, Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, came in and bought IndyMac Bank, which was this failed Pasadena, California bank, and then proceeded to foreclose on over 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors. Now, under the deal that he made with the government to acquire this bank, which the government owned because it failed, he and his investors paid the government nothing. And then, although he invested some of his own money in the bank, we then paid him to subsidize his foreclosures. And documents that I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that we paid his group more than $1 billion. And Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, had a similar deal at Bank United, which was another failed bank in Florida.
And, of course, IndyMac, as you show in your book, was really the first major bank to collapse. And then a series of others happened in 2008. And it was basically based on a lot of either fraudulent or predatory lending. If you could talk about that as well.
There were a lot of predatory loans going around in the housing bubble. And at this point, we all know that. What I wanted to know was when there were families who got these so-called ninja loans, right? No income, no job, no assets, no problem. Or these loans that had these teaser rates and then reset at a higher level. And you were told, oh, you can just refinance. Or the main character in my book, Sandy Jolly, whose family owned their home outside of Los Angeles for more than 30 years until they got a reverse mortgage that sapped their equity. And all of these families lost their homes to foreclosure. What I wanted to know was what happened after, right? We've been stuck in this country on this trauma of 2007, 2008, 2009. But now here we are in 2019. 10 years have passed. The unemployment rate is low. The president tells us everything is great, but people don't feel like everything is great. So, you know, we have jobs, but what happened to our wealth? They took it. That's what happened.
And also the disproportionate impact that this loss of equity in all these homes had, especially on the African-American and Latino communities, which were even more dependent on home equity for what little wealth they had, net wealth they had.
What we see is that banks like Steve Mnuchin's bank concentrated their foreclosures in communities of color. And then when they started making loans again, when the economy improved, they didn't make loans to those communities. So they wiped out the wealth of these communities with foreclosure. But then over a five-year period, Steve Mnuchin's bank made 3 loans to help African Americans buy homes and 11 loans. This is a national bank, helped 3 African Americans and 11 Latinos buy homes over 5 years. And now Steve Mnuchin, as the Treasury Secretary, is in charge of regulating every American bank. And so he and Donald Trump picked one of his deputies at One West Bank, Joseph Otting, for this position called Comptroller of the Currency, which basically is America's top bank cop, who's in charge of enforcing laws like the Community Reinvestment Act that are meant to stop redlining. So this bank, which didn't make any loans, hardly any, to communities of color, is now in charge, you know, its leadership under President Trump, of making sure that these anti-redlining laws are followed.
And it seems to me it's not just the Trump administration, because it was under the Obama administration that were supposed to be some efforts to help homeowners stay in their homes. And in fact, Julian Castro, now a presidential candidate, was at HUD supposedly in charge of the efforts to assist homeowners. And that's come under heavy criticism. What the Obama administration did to help these homeowners?
This book, you know, some people say it's an anti-Trump book because it has Donald Trump on the cover holding wads of cash with Steve Mnuchin riding on a wrecking ball and, you know, Wilbur Ross pulling money out of a house. But all of this activity happened, as you mentioned, when Barack Obama was the president. The homeownership rate in America, this is what got me started on this book. I started working on this book. It's an investigative book. It took years to write. I started working on it in 2016 when I didn't know who the new president was going to be. But I noticed that the homeownership rate in this country, instead of going up during the economic recovery, it kept going down. It went down in 2012, it went down in 2013, 14, 15, and 16. Until 2016, it bottomed out at its lowest rate in over 50 years. And so that's when I started asking the question, who profited under Obama?
Tell us more about Tom Barrack and Steve Schwarzman and their relationship with Trump and what they did.
So Tom Barrack is Donald Trump's oldest friend, closest friend, introduced Ivanka at the Republican National Convention, planned the inauguration for Donald Trump. Steve Schwarzman, another old Trump friend, according to media reports, still has the president on speed dial. Now, we've been talking about the foreclosures. Who bought those foreclosures? We have seen a massive transfer of wealth, as I mentioned, not from, you know, one group of families who got foreclosed to another group of families who were able to buy homes. But we now have 3 million homes in this country that are owned by LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies. And some of the largest buyers of these homes were these private equity funds run by Tom Barrack and Steve Schwarzman. So there's now a company called Invitation Homes, which was founded by Blackstone, Steve Schwarzman's company, owns 80,000 homes across more than a dozen states. And it's a private. It's a publicly traded company now that they had their IPO. So you can track. They track very clearly their rent increases, the relatively small amount of money they spend on maintenance, and also importantly, because these people are leveraged buyout kings, they have been taking these homes and bundling them into this new type of mortgage-backed security, taking on a ton of debt. So, for example, I mentioned earlier Sandy Jolly, this longtime homeowner in Los Angeles area whose family owned their home for more than 30 years before they were foreclosed on by Steve Mnuchin's bank. Now that home is part of a $960 million mortgage-backed security bundled with thousands of other homes. So if you go and look at the property record, you don't see like a $20,000 home equity line of credit to remodel the kitchen. You see a $960 million lien on the house taken out by a private equity firm.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Aaron Glantz is our guest. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist last year. His new book, out today, Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Stay with us.
Get higher. I've got the capitalist blues. When I give everything, I won't have much more to lose. I am swimming in an ocean of sharks. They are telling me how I'm gonna make.
The Capitalist Blues by Leila McCullough. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest, Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. His new book, Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Aaron, talk to us about John Paulson, another billionaire hedge fund and equity guy, who another big supporter and advisor of Donald Trump and his role in all of this.
Well, you know, Steve Mnuchin, we've been talking about Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and how he bought this bank, IndyMac, but he was just the head of a group that bought this bank. So Paulson,
he didn't have the real money. He had some money, but not the big money.
Yeah, I mean, he lives in a 6,000 square foot apartment on Park Avenue and has another house in Bel Air and another one in Scotland. But that's not the real money, right? I mean, Paulson had made billions of dollars in the run up to the housing bust. He was one of these hedge fund guys who saw that we were in a bubble, bet against the American dream, and made a ton of money. And then he's like, okay, now there's a crash. How am I going to make money on the way up again? And so his staff studied the SNL bailout. All of these guys looked at this savings and loan crisis of the late 80s, which is another time where the government intervened and bailed out the rich at the expense of the rest of us. And they used it as a playbook. And so one of the things they noticed was that some of the richest deals, the best deals for the hedge fund guys to come out of the SNL crisis came at the very beginning. And that's why they they bet on IndyMac. But what's interesting is Mnuchin, another reason he had to put together this group, is if any of these hedge funds had put in more than a certain amount of money into the bank in terms of their share of ownership, they would be regulated as bank holding companies, and the government would be able to go in and look at their books. So they all just stayed just a little bit below that threshold to make sure that they would avoid scrutiny.
So the debate is tonight, Aaron Glantz, the housing policies of the different Democratic presidential candidates.
Well, first of all, I would love to hear them talk about it in tonight's debate. I mean, the moderators have totally abdicated on asking about issues of economic equity. So as you mentioned earlier, Elizabeth Warren has a plan, Bernie Sanders has a plan, Pete Buttigieg has a plan, Kamala Harris has a plan. I'm not sure if I've heard one from Vice President Biden. But I would like to see them engage, you know, on these issues. You know, Kamala Harris says she wants to put
$100 billion towards promoting African-American home ownership. The black home ownership rate in this country is below the level that it was at when segregation and discrimination was legal. I'd like to hear her talk to Elizabeth Warren, who has a plan to give massive down payment assistance and rectify redlining. Juan was talking about Bernie Sanders' plan on rent control and affordable housing. I mean, this is something where the Democratic candidates should engage in the same way they've been engaging on health care and present their conflicting visions and debate. You know, as I mentioned at the outset, the richest 0.1% of the American people have the same amount of wealth as the other 90%. And that is because in America, 80% of most middle-class families' wealth goes to only five things: food, housing, shelter, transportation, health care. All those other things besides housing just disappear as soon as you spend your money. Housing is the only way that most Americans have to save. The average American family has $4,000 in the bank. So either you put your money in equity in your house or you pay it to your landlord, and if it's a private equity firm, it goes on the bond market. Or you have a little bit for yourself. And I'd like to see the candidates engage on this question.
And in terms of your book also does talk about some of the regulators who attempted to do the best they could to deal with the bank failures. Sheila Bair, of course, is highlighted in your book. Talk about the regulatory climate right now in terms of being able to protect homeowners and the lending industry in general.
Well, I think actually when I looked at the history of America, the thing that jumped out to me was in this financial crisis, how many people came throughout the whole process with really great ideas that were summarily ignored, you know, under President Obama. I write about Alan Blinder, who was a former member of the Federal Reserve Board, who in 2008 went with a number of other prominent economists, including members of the Conservative Enterprise Institute, and said, hey, you know what we need is a government-run bank, like President Roosevelt had during the Great Depression, which the Homeowners Loan Corporation helped more than a million Americans keep their homes. It refinanced one out of every five mortgages in urban America. It invented the long-term fixed-rate mortgage. And guess what? It made money for the taxpayers because the American people paid their loans back. After World War II, we had the GI Bill. It helped 4 million Americans buy homes. It basically broke even because the GIs paid their loans back. Instead, what we had over the past decade is this massive government giveaway to private equity and a few people who are now close friends of the president and in his administration. The really scary thing is that under President Trump, these people are running the country. And so they are bit by bit taking away the few scraps and reforms that Obama put in place, defanging the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, weakening the Dodd-Frank Act, which regulated the banks. We're seeing, as I mentioned earlier, a ballooning number of this new kinds of mortgage-backed security, $960 million lien on a single house in South Los Angeles. So this is where we're at. You know, the people who looted us during the Obama years are now running the country, and that's why the book is called Homewreckers.
We've got just 30 seconds. What shocked you most?
I think the thing that shocked me most was how many of these good ideas were proposed and how much they were ignored over more than 10 years, and that there really is no reason that we have to be in the situation we are now.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Aaron, for being with us. We're going to do part two, and we'll put it online at democracynow.org. Aaron Glenn, senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. His new book, Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Amy. We're getting old, aren't we, Amy?
We also have someone else to say happy birthday to. Happy birthday to Miguel Noguera, our engineer, and congratulations to our producer, Tammy Warrenoff, and her husband, Dave Rowley, on the birth of their son, Quentin Akira Warrenoff Rowley. Welcome to the world, Q. And that does it for our show. Go to our website at democracynow.org for all of our podcasts. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, the birthday boy.
Blowing
Thanks so much for joining us. Make a wish, Juan.